Bhagavate Vasudevaya Sasta,
Sasta,
Arigopta,
Arigopta,
Aripati,
Aripati,
Rajanam,
Rajanam,
Ya,
Ya,
Kinkaraha,
Kinkaraha,
Vahana,
Vinasti
Vishtam,
Vinasti Vishtam,
Svadharmam,
Svadharmam,
Aradhana,
Aradhanam,
Achyutasya,
Achyutasya,
Ya,
Ya,
Iha,
the well-wisher of the citizens.
as a father is the well-wisher of his children.
As a father is the well-wisher of his children.
Nripatihi,
Nripatihi,
the king.
King.
Rajanam,
Rajanam,
of the citizens.
Of the citizens.
Yaha,
Yaha,
one who.
One who.
Kinkaraha,
Kinkaraha,
order carrying.
Why?
Indeed. Na,
na,
na.
No.
Vinashti Pishtam.
Vinashti Pishtam.
Grinds what is already ground.
Grinds what is already ground.
Svadharman.
Svadharman.
One's own occupation of duty.
One's own occupation of duty.
Aradhanam.
Aradhanam.
Worship.
Worship.
Achyutasya.
Achyutasya.
Of the Supreme Personality of God.
Of the Supreme Personality of God.
Yat.
Which.
Nihamanaha.
Nihamanaha.
Perform.
Perform.
Vijahati.
Vijahati.
Where released from.
Where released from.
Agha Oham.
Agha Oham.
All kinds of sinful activity.
All kinds of sinful activity.
And faulty action.
And faulty action.
Translation Shilpa. My dear sir, you have said that the relationship between the king and the subject, or between the master and the servant, are not eternal. But although such relationships are temporary, when a person takes the position of the king, his duty is to rule the citizens and punish those who are disobedient to the laws. By punishing them, he teaches the citizens to obey the laws of the state. Again, you have said that punishing of a person who is deaf and dumb is like chewing the chute or grinding the pulp. That is to say, there is no benefit in it. However, if one is engaged in his own occupational duty, as ordered by the Supreme Lord, his sinful activities are certainly diminished. Therefore, if one is engaged in his occupational duty by force, he benefits because he can vanquish all his sinful activities in that way. This argument offered by Maharaja Rahugana is certainly very effective. In his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami says, Tasmat kinat upayena mana krishne niveshayat. Somehow or other, one should engage in Krishna consciousness. Actually, every living being is an eternal servant of Krishna. But due to forgetfulness, a living entity engages himself as an eternal servant of Maya. As long as one is engaged in Maya's service, he cannot be hidden. Our Krishna consciousness movement aims at engaging people in Lord Krishna's service. That will help them to become freed from all contamination and sinful activity. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Vitaragavaya Pratham. By becoming detached from material activities, we will be free from fear and anger. By austerity, one becomes purified and eligible to return home back to Godhead. The duty of the king is to rule his citizens in such a way that they can become Krishna conscious. This would be very beneficial for everyone. Unfortunately, the king or president engages people in self-gratification instead of the Lord's service, and such activities are certainly not beneficial for anyone. King Rahugana tried to engage Jadabharata in carrying the palanquin, which is a form of self-gratification for the king. However, if one is engaged as a palanquin carrier in the Lord's service, that is certainly beneficial. In this godless civilization, if a president engages people somehow or other in devotional service or the awakening of Krishna consciousness, he renders the very best service to the citizens. Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Sasari loktavane kati patani. Yah kinkaravayana pinashti bhikram svadharmani. Aradhan mashitasya. Translation again. My dear sir, you have said that the relationship between the king and the subjects, or between the master and the servant, are not eternal. But although such relationship are temporary, when a person takes the position of a king, his duty is to rule the citizens and punish those who are disobedient to this law, to the law. By punishing them, he teaches the citizens to obey the laws of the state. Again, you have said that punishing the person who is deaf and dumb is like chewing the chewed or grinding the pulp. That is to say, there is no benefit in him. However, if one is engaged in his own occupational duty as ordered by the Supreme Lord, his sinful activities are certainly diminished. Therefore, if one is engaged in his occupational duty by force, he benefits because he can vanquish all his sinful activities in that way. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasadaya Gurudev Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarini Vancha Loka Dharmyascha Kripa Sindhu Virvacha Padita Nama Param Vyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Vedavatara Shivasati Gauravakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So it's a very fundamentalistic verse of purport. And you have to very clearly understand the meaning of this thing. First of all, we have to know the context. And the context is interesting. Because here we have the encounter or the clash between two ideologies. Actually, the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, especially the first cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, the beginning cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, are composed in such a way that there is a clash. Like in the fourth canto, we have the clash of Daksha and Shiva. And Daksha and Shiva are not just mythological figures. It's not just a nice story. It is an interesting story to hear, but they represent a certain position, certain ideological, you know, world views. And the clash which is described in the fourth canto is the clash, or in the fifth canto, is the clash of these ideologies, of these worldviews. And here we can see the same kind of situation in case of Jadavarata and Kidrahuban. Each of them represents a certain worldview or certain conception of life. And when they meet, inevitably these conceptions clash. And very interesting result comes out from this clash. So, in the fifth canto here, particularly, the whole fifth canto is about renunciation. It's actually jnana. Or jnana visvabhakti, one can say. It describes the correct renunciation, incorrect renunciation, and different examples, different stories are all more or less centered around this topic or this point. And we can see here, again, the same kind of situation to reveal more clearly the nature of devotional service. Here we can see King Rahugana. And King Rahugana represents, as we can see from this verse very clearly, he represents Nishkam Karma. More or less, if we analyze all the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam which describes King Rahugana, we can see that he is this karmi, but on a very elevated position. It's Nishkam Karma. There is no doubt about it. Just a few verses before, Sukadeva Goswami glorifies King Rahugana. He says King Rahugana was really, really into searching for absolute truth. And he was totally renounced in one sense. He was not really into the fruits. And we can see here, he is propounding a certain philosophy. And the philosophy which he is propounding in this particular verse is very limited. He says, you should do your duty. You should strictly work according to the duties of the varna and ashrama, of your social position.
And by this performing your duty without being attached to the fruits of your action, you will purify your heart. You will be purified from the sins. And that's definitely, that's the description. This basically, this verse is a very nice and very concise description of the philosophy of Nishkam Karma. You perform your duty, and if you do it without attachment to the fruits, if you do it and you want to enjoy the fruits, you know, I'm such and such, I perform these duties very perfectly, but I want to enjoy the fruits. Like so many different other heroes of Srimad Bhagavatam, like King Riga. There's another example of Sakam Karma. He wanted to perform sacrifices and to give charity, but he wanted to enjoy the fruits. So the difference between one and another is that if you perform the fruits and perform the duties of your social order as prescribed in the shastras, but you're still attached to the fruits and you want to enjoy the fruits, your heart will not be purified. No matter how perfectly you perform the duties, you may be perfect householder, perfect renouncing, you know, but if you want to enjoy the fruits, this little thing, little tiny defect, your desires will never be fulfilled. Because purification of the heart means that your desires are fulfilled and you feel satisfied. But when the heart is impure, there is an unlimited source of desires inside. And you fulfill one desire, another desire comes, and another desire comes, and another desire comes. There is this fountain of desires. There is a perpetuum mobile of desires. Sometimes it is said that there is nothing unending in this material world. Everything has a beginning and end. But there is one thing which doesn't have an end. This is material desires. The stream of material desires is in the heart. If one still remains attached. So therefore, the methodology for purifying the heart, there is only one methodology. Besides the transcendental methodology, if we still remain within the realm of this material world, there is only one methodology. You perform the duties which are prescribed in the scriptures. You try to do it as perfectly as possible, but somehow or other, you should not manifest any interest in the fruits of these duties, which is extremely difficult. Because after all, you know, it's so difficult to perform the duties. But still, what we can see here this attitude in King Sakugana, and we can see also the imperfections of this attitude. Even though he represents this attitude, and Sukadeva Goswami himself glorifies him, we see that he becomes angry. And it means that his heart is not purified. He sees that this Jadabharata, this dull, you know, carrier of palm queen is just limping on one hand or on one leg, cannot really walk properly, and he becomes angry. He forgets everything about the transcendental realization. of course, we can also see some defect, unfortunately, in Jadabharata too. Because he also becomes angry when he is being chastised. And he starts saying, who you are? You think you are master? You are master now. I was also master of last life. And you may become servant next life. So it's still not the level of complete pure saying. But there is an interesting dynamic here, because still, of course, Jadabharata is in a much higher position. One of the reasons why he speaks is because he is a little agitated by the harsh words of King Rakugan. But another reason, of course, Sukadeva Goswami explains, he wants to enlighten. And the proof for this is that he starts preaching to King Rakugan. But just before that was another scene, another story, another clash, when he was almost assassinated by the rogues. You know, the rogues caught him and said, this is a nice animal. He's deaf and dumb, and he's perfectly, he's body is very important, so we can sacrifice him. And at that time, he didn't start, you know, preaching to the rocks and thieves. He didn't open his mouth. He was still remaining deaf and dumb. He didn't want to protect his life. He was just, you know, anyway. He was totally resigned to the will of the Lord. But here he speaks. And this is actually the recognition of the high position of King Prahuma. Because he knows the king will hear. It's rocks and thieves. What is the use? What is the use to give pearls to the swines? They will just, you know, they will not appreciate us. But he knows, King Rahugana can. So, and basically what we see here in this particular clash, on this particular collision with Srimad Bhagavatam, is this gradual progression. When one performs nishkam karma, the real result of this nishkam karma is purification of the heart, and as a result of this purification of the heart, jnana, or distinct feeling that I am spirit soul, should come. But still it cannot come without some intervention. And we can see that in this situation, when Jada Bharata will start propounding this whole philosophy of this pure spirit soul, which, as Sukadeva Goswami says, is loosening the knot in the heart. But we can see, you know, people perform karma, even nishkam karma. Why? Because this is ideal for them. Krishna, you know, a lot of verses devotes to this description of nishkam karma because he knows if you too prematurely jump to jnana, you know, you will be in a very precarious position. Because first you have to really go through this, and this is more natural and this is more safe. King Rahugana is doing this, but still to acquire jnana, real feeling that I am soul, is not so easy. And we can see that King Rahugana, he is defending his position. He's saying, you know, of course, yes, I know I'm the soul. He says to Jada Bharata. Jada Bharata, in a very kind of little angry and agitated mood, said, you know, who do you think you are? You think you are a big guy and I'm a small guy. But actually, you know, we're all the same. And I'm not really carrying you. This is my body carrying you, and I'm the spirit soul. And King Rahugana, he answered this. My dear sir, how is that practical? Please tell me, you know, is it the practical philosophy? Well, like sometimes, you know, when the devotee is sick, we come to him and say, Prabhu, you're not this body, why you? Why do you lay down? Just do devotional service. So in the same way, King Rahugana says, you know, you may say such nice words, I am spirit soul, but it's the soul which feels the pain. It's the soul is affected by the body. And of course, we know the answer to this doubt which King Rahugana has. The soul only feels the effect of the body as long as the soul is attached to the body. And to the extent we are attached to the body, we are affected by this body. We more or less give the right to some objects of this world, including our body, to control us as much as we are attached to this. This is a very important point which we have to understand. And this is the answer to the previous verse of King Rahugana in his speech. You know, as much as we are attached to the object, we have to understand very clearly that to the same extent we give to this object the right to control us, the right to enslave us. You know, the perfect example is the husband and wife relationship. If the husband is attached to the wife, what it means? It means he says, my dear, beautiful, beloved, lotus-eyed wife, please control me. And she knows, you know, this guy is attached, so I can push him around and I can do whatever I like. So, and if he was not attached, she would not control him. So this is the same kind of situation which later on Jadabharata will explain to King Prabhupada. He said, you may say that this is a practical, that this philosophy of this pure spirit soul, which is not really have any connection with the body, is totally impractical. But he says, no, it's practical. It's impractical as long as you remain attached to the body. But as soon as you become unattached to the body, it becomes very practical. But here, and in this particular verse, it's interesting because in all other verses of King Prabhupada's speech, Srila Prabhupada in the purport says something different. He says, no, he's not right. Because he's attached. This is the defect. He's attached. He is still within this realm of karma, within this realm of material world, and therefore, you know, whatever he is, you know, blubbering there is not really correct. But here, Prabhupada very enthusiastically agrees with King Rahuman. He starts Prabhupada says, this argument offered by Maharaja Rahuman is certainly very effective. And what King Rahuman is saying in this verse, it's actually Prabhupada doesn't give the exact translation of the verse. He gives the what is called anuvad, bhava anuvad, not just anuvad, but bhava anuvad. Shri Radha Gopala Nanda ki jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Govinda ki jai. He gives bhava anuvad of free translation, and usually when Prabhupada gives this bhava anuvad a very free, flowing translation. He usually just translates Sridhar Swami comment on this verse. I didn't check in this particular verse, but I'm pretty sure that this elaborate translation is the comment of Sridhar Swami to this verse. And basically, what King Rahupana is saying here is that he gives another argument how this philosophy of pure spirit soul is not practical in the social environment, in the social fabric of the society. He says, you may be true saying that this master and servant relationship is not eternal. Not maybe true, you are true. There is no doubt about it. But still, we have to fulfill certain roles in the society. You know, because I'm playing the role of the master, you have to play the role of the servant. And my role as a master is to make sure that you fulfill your dirty servant, fulfill your duties as a servant. And if I don't make sure that you're fulfilling the duties of the servant, I will not be fulfilling my duties. And everything will go to hell. And nobody will be happy because nobody will fulfill their particular duties. The whole society will be totally chaotic. Everything will just be upside down. The masters will be servants, the servants will be masters. And we have a very vivid example in front of our eyes. In Soviet Russia, when the revolution, communist revolution took place, all the Shudras, they said, now we are, you know, we're not Shudras anymore. We are the masters. And everyone else should serve us. But nothing good happened because of this. So, what King Rahupana is saying in this argument, he says that still, even though we may know theoretically that we're spirit soul, we're still in this material world. And we still have to act according to the roles and situations and positions of this material world and perform our duties accordingly. And this is the only way for the human being to purify the heart. Because if you try to propound some other philosophy, you more or less automatically deprive yourself from the chance of purifying the heart. He says, this premature jnana, this is his very strong argument, this premature propaganda of this philosophy, that I'm spirit soul, and the attempt to imitate the action of the spirit soul while still being attached in the body, is basically the straight way to hell. Because if you try to imitate this and not fulfill your duties, and I know this, you know, sometimes devotees do this, you know, they say, oh, this is a very good philosophy, this is a very convenient philosophy. very nice philosophy. I have spirit soul. It means that, you know, there is this nice verse in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which I remember. This was one of the first verses which I, you know, remembered by heart. Where it is said that Nakim Karanayam and Vinicharajan, Bhutapta, what is this? Devarshi Bhutapta Rinam Pitrinam Nakim Karanayam and Vinicharajan. If someone becomes a pure devotee, there is no duties. He doesn't, you know, there is no debts to be paid. And sometimes devotees say, you know, they take the debt and they say, I'm a devotee, I don't have to give it back. Because it is said in Srimad Bhagavatam, not King Karanayam Rinicharajam. You know. So that's exactly what King Rakhugan is trying to argue with. He says, you know, my dear sir, you may be right from the theoretical point of view, but how is that right from the practical point of view? We're still here, and you're still my servant, and I'm still your master. And you still have to do it. And then he says there is another argument is given here. He says that my dear sir, you say that the punishment which is administered to a deaf and dumb person or somebody who is really dumb, you know, who is a madman, basically. If you punish him, what is the use of punishing? So this was the argument of Jadavarata. Jadavarata said this to King Rakhugana, you try to punish me, but what is the use to punish me? If I know that I'm spirit soul, you cannot punish me, and if I'm just deaf and dull, as you think I am, then what is the use to punish me? So, but here, King Rakhugana says, no, still there is a use of punishment. King Rakhugana says, still it's good to punish you, because it's good for you. Because you're not fulfilling your duties. I don't know where to take you from this point. Whether he is wrong or he is right. Because Prabhupada says, we'll take to the direction of Prabhupada. Prabhupada says, in this particular verse, King Rakhugana is right. King Rakhugana is right, which is amazing, because he is not supposed to be the right guy. He is supposed to be the bad guy. And this particular clash of illusion. But Prabhupada, very enthusiastically, not just, you know, half-heartedly he says he is right. He's very enthusiastic. He says, he is right, yes, let's punish all these guys who are not performing bhakti. And as I said, when we analyze these statements, sometimes it may sound for us as a very, downright fundamentalism. Because Prabhupada says, yeah, that's good. If the king more or less forcibly forces all his subjects to perform devotional service, that's good. That's very good. He says, King Rakhugana says this, yes. If the king is really, you know, pushy and he forces his subjects to perform devotional service, this is very good. And this is definitely fundamentalism. There's no doubt about it. And the first look on you. Like recently somebody told me the rules and laws in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, if you happen to be on the street, no matter who you are, you may be a tourist, you may be an American feminist, or you may be, you know, somebody else. If you happen to be on the street during the time of, five times of the prayers, which Muslims are supposed to do, there is a special religious police there. And this religious police has a stick. And if you are foolish enough to, you know, to walk on the street during the time when you're supposed to pray, according to the strict rules of Muslim religion, you will be beaten by sticks. You will be pushed into the house. So more or less, we see this heavy, heavy institutionalized religion. When the king is supposed to see that everyone is performing his religious duties. And we are being brought in a very liberal Mayavad society of the modern days. This modern liberality, which is post-Christian, kind of phenomenon. It's actually Mayavada. The whole Western world is filled with Mayavada. As we sing every day, Prabhupada Sanati, and we say, Nirvishesha Sunyavadi, Paschatya Desha Tarini. You're liberating all these Western countries, which are filled with Mayavada and Buddhism, and covered Buddhism, and covered Mayavada, and basically atheism. Because Mayavada is an atheism, ultimately. So this, we are being Mayavadis and atheists and Buddhists deep down in heart. Just on the surface, a little devotional, you know, clothes and some garland is there. But ultimately, Mayavadis. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right. But and we still have to understand what we are. Are we Vaishnava fundamentalists, or who we are? Or we are liberal Vaishnavas with the Western kind of inclinations? Because we see in this modern world the clash between these two ideologies. One is this Mayavada, and another one is narrow-minded. And it doesn't, you know, neither of these feel. But if we had to choose between the two, we would probably choose the first one, the liberal Mayavada. Than this, you know, narrow-minded fundamentalist attitude. But still we see some kind of slant or tinge of this fundamentalism in Prabhupada's statement. And he was even more strong in his practical dealings. Indradyumna Maharaj once told a parallel story, which I liked very much. He said, once in France, and France is more or less the most atheistic country. Really difficult country, difficult people, so atheistic, so engrossed in sense of joy. So, Indradyumna Maharaj said that once they went on Harinam in France, and he came back very morose after the Harinam. Because during the Harinam, one French lady, elderly lady, came to the Harinam party, and she stood in front of the Harinam party by pushing her fingers into the ears, and by doing this, you know, she was standing for 2 or 3 hours in front of Harinam. completely spoiling everyone's mood and everything. And the Yomraj was leading the Harinam, and here you see this lady, she's going everywhere, you know, chasing you, saying you're crazy. I don't want to hear what you have to say, but I know that you're crazy. That's basically was the meaning. She was really offensive and insulting. She really was mean. So it affected him very much. He came back and Prabhupada saw him, and he saw that he's very sad and morose. So Prabhupada asked, what happened? And he said, no, nothing happened, you know, we had a very happy Harinam, enthusiastic, and we were preaching the holy name. Prabhupada looked at him and said, what happened? Tell me what happened. And the Yungman reluctantly told the story. He said, there was this nasty lady, nasty French lady, as nasty as French people can be. And she was doing it. She really spoiled the whole mood and the whole Harinam, you know. And Prabhupada looked at him and said, you should have, you know, Radhyamma was asking, I don't remember exactly, but he just Prabhupada said himself, what we're supposed to do in such conditions. And Prabhupada said immediately, you should have approached this lady and pulled out your fingers. That you hear the holy name. And next time you should do this. So, I mean, it's a very strong attitude. You know, you go to some, you know, it's totally against the grain of Western society. You more or less try to force this upon the people. You know, you force, and that's exactly what we're doing. That's why people don't like us, because we're not my allies. We're not exactly my That's why they don't like us. We go and preach, we go and more or less, you know, force them to hear the holy name, even though they don't want to hear the holy name. you know, this boys in Sofa Street, they're standing on the corner, you know, and on the Oxford Street, and chanting the holy name. And that's more or less the principle which Prabhupada enunciates in this purport, when he says that this is a duty. This is a duty of the Krishna consciousness movement, and this is a duty of the king to make sure that people are, even by force, are engaged in devotional service. And he quotes to confirm this attitude, Śrīla Rūpa Gosvāmī, tasmāt kenāpi upāyena, manā kṛṣṇe niveśate. And somehow or other, you have to engage your mind in Krishna. And that ultimately will bring good to you. And the idea here is much deeper than fundamentalism. We are not fundamentalists. This is a good news. We are not. We are not crazy fundamentalists, because this clash between these two things, between the liberality and fundamentalism, and the third alternative which we are supposed to follow, was very beautifully analyzed by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in the example of Haridas Thakur. When Haridas Thakur was beaten and was punished by the king, they are commenting on this episode. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gives a brilliant analysis. He says, he more or less analyzes according to this dialectics of Hegel. He says that the thesis here is liberal attitude of the atheists. Because atheists or Mayavadis, they say, everyone is right. No matter what you do, you're right. This is what it's, you know, all this liberal ideology is boiled down to. And, you know, America is definitely the policeman which is trying to enforce this ideology upon the whole world. You know, everyone is right. Everyone has the right to do whatever he likes, as long as, you know, they are not encroaching on my right to enjoy. You can only be punished if you are somehow or other make an obstacle for me to enjoy freely. But if you are enjoying yourself, I don't mind. You enjoy yourself and I will enjoy myself, and we will nicely enjoy ourselves and become impersonalist and become totally dumb. So this is the philosophy, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says, this understanding of tolerance, because sometimes people say, this is the tolerance. This is the policy which we should follow, which the whole world should follow. This is tolerance. But it's actually deep down, it's an ethics. It's a very bad case of an ethics. Because your heart becomes totally, completely indifferent. This so-called tolerance is the manifestation of this mayava or impersonalism or indifference of the heart. When you basically don't care, you only care about your own enjoyment. That's it. That's what you care about. Then he says antithesis to this. The opposite proposition to this is this fundamentalism, which is actually also wrong. Why is it wrong? Because, you know, some foolish people who see this attitude, they try to force upon people make them surrender by force, and they try to force upon people all this religious ideology which actually doesn't give them any good. What we can see in Muslim countries, I was recently in Dubai, in Emirates, where this ideology or this kind of system is being enforced, it only breeds hypocrisy. You know, you force people to do religion. But ultimately, because they are forced, they don't do it willingly. And because they don't do it willingly, ultimately they become hypocrites. You can see all these Muslims who are outwardly very religious. But then, you know, as soon as nobody sees them, they go to, you know, pubs and drink and, you know, do all kinds of nonsense. The devotees there, they told me all kind of horror stories. The so-called religious people who are supposed to be so, you know, strictly following their religion, when there is a slight chance to do something which is against religion, they will jump upon this chance They will be happy, they will enjoy this chance. And they go during this Ramadan, this holy month. You know, the holy month, you are supposed to fast. Because fasting is the main austerity for religious people. So they fast during the day. And Prophet Muhammad, he was fasting for 40 days without, you know, taking any food. And after that, he got this revelation that's in the heart. But they're fasting during the day. As soon as the sun sets, they eat, and the whole night they eat and eat and eat. They cannot stop, you know. And then before the sun rises, they again got up and they eat again. And this is what it breeds, you know. This kind of forceful attempts to breed religion, it's intolerance, first of all. You know, you do all kinds of atrocities on the name of religion. You kill people, you do these kind of things. And deep down in the heart, you remain hypocrite. Because you feel this force. But what is the difference between this proposition and the proposition which Prabhupada gives in this purport? And at this point, knowing that I'm late, I want to ask you, would you like to know? It's great to get some extra time to speak for somebody who has uncontrolled tongue. But the answer is, the answer which Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami, the Guru Prabhupada, gives to this, he says that, that why the other people are wrong, because they force upon themselves the right, or that they take upon themselves the right, they encroach the right of God to punish others. And what is the difference between this proposition and the proposition of fundamentalist is that it's a long topic, but I'll try to be brief in this regard. Basically, what is said here, what Prabhupada is propounding here and suggesting here, is a very deep philosophy of ours, which can be summarized in the verse of 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhaktya Sanjaya Bhaktya. That bhakti, the only source of bhakti is bhakti. And there is different kinds of bhakti. And we are into administering people this bhakti because we know that this is the only remedy from all the sufferings of society. And there are different ways of giving people this bhakti. And the main and measure, the major way of giving people bhakti is to bring them in contact with those who have bhakti in the heart. And this is the preliminary condition for us being effective. No matter what we do, you know, if there is bhakti in our heart, it will bring good to the people. This is the preliminary, this is the step number one. It's not just force. Yes, there will be force, and there could be force. There is a room for force. But the beginning is that you have to have bhakti within your heart. And bhakti means you have to have soft heart. And if you punish with this soft heart, if you more or less force people to do bhakti with this soft heart, which is bleeding out of compassion for all these people, not just punish because of punishment, not just punish because you want to establish your own position as somebody great, not just punish because you want to enforce everyone your stupid religion and you want, you know, to see everyone enslaved by being followers of this religion. But you do it because you have the bhakti within your heart. And because you're compassionate and because you want to really bring something good to these people. This is the step number one. Then you're allowed to do this. And what you are, basically what you're allowed to do this, you're allowed to engage them one way or another in bhakti, because sadhana bhakti is also bhakti. And sadhana bhakti, even if it's performed somewhat unwillingly, somewhat under some pressure, it still brings bhakti. Whereas, if it's just enforced upon you, and there is no bhakti from the beginning in what you're doing, then it doesn't bring any good to you, it makes you hypocrite. But if the bhakti is administered by bhakti, even with some force, because what is Vaidhi Bhakti? Vaidhi Bhakti is force. When we perform Vaidhi, it means, you know, and those people who live in Soka Street, they know, you know, you have to get up and you shouldn't miss Mangalarati. You have to do it. And then you have to come to the second part of the program and you have to see. And this is forced. But because this is Bhakti, and because this is done with the intention, with the motivation of Bhakti, this ultimately will bring Bhakti within you. Whereas, if these conditions are not fulfilled, it will not bring bhakti, it will not bring any good to you. It will only make you a hypocrite. It will only make you even an offender, basically, of the religion. But this kind of force is allowed because this is the force which actually really brings eternal good to you. Because you are coming in contact with this transcendental force of bhakti. The bhakti is Svarupa Shakti of the Lord. And no matter which form it takes, it's still Svarupa Shakti, it's still spiritual. And even if it's, somehow or other, this is the manifestation of the compassion of the pure devotee, and if this compassion manifests in such a way that, you know, he is more or less pushing upon you bhakti, that will purify your heart. And we can see how this methodology was applied by Srila Prabhupada himself. You know, he was more or less, you know, he was so compassionate. He went in the age of 70, you know, God knows where, in a hellish place. And he says himself, he looks at this America. he admits, he said, when I was about to go to America, I saw that there is nothing there to eat except for meat. And I was mentally preparing myself to eat meat. You know, he said, I was traveling on this Javadutta sheep, and I was saying, how will I meet me? How will I do it? You know, this is the extent of compassion. This is the extent of bhakti which is there in his heart. And when he forces, and he does force, he said, you should chant, you know. Give up your nonsense. This is the force, you know. Get up at 4 o'clock. This is, my goodness, this is violence. I want to sleep. He said, no, you're not supposed to sleep. This is Mangalarati. This is Brahma Muhurta. Get up. Chant the body name. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah. And please take some gulab jamun. So reluctant to do it otherwise. But if this is done with this intention, with this motivation, and with this heart, then only it brings some benefit to people. Then only it brings the eternal benefit. And therefore, Prabhupada jumps on this opportunity to explain the whole methodology of Krishna Consciousness Movement. He says here that this is what we're doing. Tasmat kinapi upayena, manah Krishna niveshaya. Somehow or other, by hook and by crook, sometimes Prabhupada would translate this verse in a very special way. By hook and by crook, engage people's mind and your own mind in Krishna consciousness. Think about Krishna. By all means, and that, this will bring eternal good to you no matter what. And this is more or less the basis of the foundation of our whole movement. I'm really sorry for speaking so long. Thank you very much. Do I have a bite of the questions?
On that very point about force, that you'd almost have to write a comprehensive manual to really explicitly guide individuals like myself of what you're trying to get across there. Because so much of the movement in the past has been that force, and they haven't had that insight for compassion at the right time either. And this balance thing hasn't been there. So, so much of the move in the last 5 years, 10 years now,
See, there is no manual. You cannot substitute bhakti by manual. Again, the step number one is to have this kindness in the heart. Because when there is no kindness in the heart, when there is no bhakti in the heart, no matter what you do, you are wrong. If you force somebody, you are wrong. It creates violence. If you don't force anyone, you're still wrong. Because it creates indifference. It creates just this, you know, total dryness in the heart. And that's exactly what we see. We went from one extreme by forcing people, by being downright, you know, fundamentalist, into this other extreme. We are now liberal, wishy-washy Mayavadis in our approach sometimes. That you can see. You go to a temple, and there is absolutely no force, but there is no love either. And because there is no love, this, you know, people are not forced, but they are not getting any benefit by being in the temple. They are only, you know, becoming more and more impersonalistic. And you go there and you see all the Brahmacharya, and they are already almost merged. You know. So much so that they cannot even smile. You know. And they don't care about you. And, you know, this is, sometimes it is, you know, being done under the banner of, you know, being liberal and forceful. But there is a room for force if there is a bhakti in the heart. But if there is no bhakti in the heart, no matter how many manuals you write, it will not bring about any good. So the main stress which we should do, without going from one extreme into another extreme, actually, the manual is the attitude of the soft heart of the bhakti. Whatever there, whatever movement is there in the heart is the manual. And sometimes bhakta is soft like a rose petal. And sometimes bhakta is hard like a thunderbolt. Why? He knows. His heart knows what he should do. And this particular occasion, he has to smash something. And he has to force it, being compassionate. And that's the motivation. Another particular condition, he has to just embrace him and say, yeah, you're right, everything is okay, everything is fine. But you cannot write the manual. And if your heart is deaf, there's no manual from this disease. The heart should become sensitive. And the heart is sensitive, then you know when to apply the force and when to apply some other method.
Something wrong in terms of your attitude or your behavior in that context to guide somebody. The reason
happy
about
it
seems to know the manual in their head about what
you
should do at that moment. So surely we
can
write those things down and give
you guidelines.
We're very much.
There is, yeah. No, there is no doubt about it. There is a question of guidelines. But what I want to say is that if the first condition is not fulfilled, the guidelines will not work. Or they work in a limited scope. It's limited. It should be there. There's no doubt about it. I'm not against the guidelines. The guidelines should be there. But the main guideline is to develop bhakti. And you can only develop bhakti by seeing one living example of bhakti and by associating with somebody who has bhakti and by imbibing this mood of bhakti. That's what it is. Otherwise, you know, this is a very subtle thing. You cannot really put bhakti into the manual, in a sense. It's a feeling. It's a mood. And you can very easily pick up this mood if you see somebody who has bhakti. And if you don't see this person, you don't know what to do. You try to follow the instruction. Okay, now I have to do this. What do I have to do next? Won't work. It will be a failure. But we have to do this. There's no doubt about it. But we should neglect them in the essence.
Should we point on this, that we shouldn't see this kind of force and compassion as two extremes? Because this is discipline. The force probably something like this discipline. And the Guru is there for discipline because he has had the realization to see what we need to do. Yeah. And really, even if we do have the intention to see what we need to do, we don't have the real power. So he has the discipline. And it comes from compassion.
Yeah.
So in some ways, we don't want to be called by God. after a while, you feel bad if you are there for Radha or Vishwa.
Yeah. So that's good. Therefore, I say it's good. Therefore, I say that it's good. We have to apply force. Yeah, discipline, force, whatever it is, discipline. Because Vaidhi Bhakti means discipline. That's good. That's very good. But, you know, the motivation should be correct. Because if the motivation is not there, if the correct motivation is not there, even this discipline does not, or may not bring as much benefit as it could, basically. That's
true. Well, I just want to know how the qualified for the hearing. So you're saying that if you get to see an example of Bhakti, but can we hear an example of Bhakti? I'll just have to be the belief of that personal association.
It's possible because even by reading Srimad Bhagavatam you get some benefit. But it's still some kind of preliminary. I actually wanted to tell a little story, and I forgot to tell during the lecture, that there was an example of force in our history, of this institutionalized force. When Bhakti was was forced by the ruler. This is the famous or infamous King Virahamvira from Vana Vishnupur. And he became, when he was converted into Vaishnavism, into Vaishnava religion by Srinivasacharya, he made a law in the country that all those who are practicing the holy name, chanting the holy name, they are tax exempt. There is no taxes extra. And those who are not, heavy taxes are applied, some extra taxes. So he was doing this, following this rule. At least that's what I heard from the other guys. Who knows? I never read it, but I don't know. But there is a nice example of this in this particular king, Virahamvira. We know that he was a rogue. He was really rogue. He was a rascal. He was exploiting his citizens. He was robbing everyone, you know. And the citizens would talk with each other. This guy, even if he sees little money, he's just after this money. But at the same time, he was a lover of Srimad Bhagavatam. He was listening to Srimad Bhagavatam daily. Nitya Bhagavata Sevaya. He had his court pandit, and the court pandit would read Srimad Bhagavatam. But because the court pandit was not a devotee himself, there's some kind of preliminary or Agyata Sukriti was coming because of the service of Srimad Bhagavatam, and that's why it actually manifested in his encounter or meeting with Srinivasacharya, where his heart was totally transformed. Before that, he was acquiring some kind of Sukriti or Agyata Sukriti, some kind of bhakti, and because of contact with Srimad Bhagavatam by hearing. But it still was not enough. He was still going with his ways. He was remaining a rogue, a thief, a rascal, a criminal. But as soon as he saw Srinivasacharya, and as soon as he heard Srinivasacharya explain the Srimad Bhagavatam, he started crying. He said, "I'm not good at what it is." Actually, no. Actually, his heart was transformed. It's actually, again, very interesting, which confirms your point. It is said in Bhakti Ratnakara that the first transformation was in his heart took place when he saw the books which he has stolen. He saw these books, and there was such a Shakti emanating from these books. This Bhakti which was emanating from this book, he said, and he was expecting jewels. He was expecting, you know, gold and jewels and this. He was not the least frustrated when he saw the books. And that's amazing. That's amazing fact. You know, all his servants, the rogues and thieves who robbed Srinivasacharya and his first Sankirtan party, when they saw the books, they said, "He will kill us now. He will put us in prison. We're supposed to bring the great treasure to him." And said, "We brought some books." But the king, because again, his heart was prepared from this hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, and he saw the books. goodness, this is the real thing. And at that time his heart was transformed, and it was totally, completely transformed by his Srinivasacharya, and he heard him explain the Srinivasacharya. So still, you know, there is no substitute, you need to see the person who is manifestation.
Thank you, Maharaj, for this question. You're mentioning about the Maya body, who is indifferent and impersonal. I ever did caught your understanding the term Maya body, because I remember reading, I think it was in CC, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he gave an example of what Maya body means. It means someone who sees Krishna or any of his entourage or paraphernalia as material, as Maya. So that's kind of my understanding of Mayavad. But
well, there are different grades and shades of Mayavad and different definitions of Mayavad. Yes, this is Mayavad, but ultimately the effect which Mayavad philosophy has on the heart is that you become indifferent. That's it. You become totally, completely, you know, impersonal. That's what impersonal is. You don't see the process in others. You start with this ideology that Krishna's form is Maya. You start. But then the logical conclusion is that everything is Maya and everyone is Maya and, you know, everything is Maya. And you don't care about the feelings of others, you don't care about the emotions of others, you don't care about anything. And that's the perfection of Maya philosophy. Or the development of Maya philosophy was in the heart. The effect of Maya philosophy in the heart. Now that's what it is. I think it's late. Thank you very much. Shiva Prabhupada.
Jai! Is all in respect to the Gyan Maharaj?
Jai!